At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Copenhagen didn't really do much on greenhouse gas emissions, and the Senate is still stuck on its energy bill. So today, the EPA stepped up. Now, how much do you suppose it's going to cost to meet the new rules for smog? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, today the 7th of January. Glad to have you with us. All right, now everybody do this for me, would you? Take a deep breath, hold it, and exhale. I did that because today the Environmental Protection Agency proposed tough new limits for the most persistent air pollutant out there, smog. It's going to cost companies and eventually consumers a pretty penny to clean up emissions to meet those new standards, and not just in the big urban corridors either. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
Search for an iconic picture of smog, and chances are you'll find a shot of the Los Angeles skyline. And for good reason. Smog forms when tailpipe and industrial emissions mix with sunlight, ingredients LA has in spades. Frank O'Donnell with Clean Air Watch says the good news is that smog is much better today than it was 40 years ago.
The bad news is that we know a lot more now than we used to about the damage that smog can do. And we know now that lower levels of smog can cause much greater damage than we previously thought.
Which means it's not just a threat to the health of urban residents, but also people living in the Dakotas, in Iowa, in Nevada. The list goes on. Under the Bush administration, EPA scientists found that even these rural residents are at risk of higher heart and respiratory illnesses associated with smog. And according to the EPA, the tens of billions of dollars to treat those illnesses is roughly equal to the cost of meeting the new standards. But the companies that would be forced to bear those costs, from lawnmower makers to agribusiness and oil refineries, aren't exactly lining up. Here's Howard Feldman with the American Petroleum Institute, the oil industry's chief lobby.
Obviously, as a society, we've gone after the cheapest and most efficient emissions reductions first. So as you're talking about needing more emissions reductions, you know, that last pound costs more and more to take out of the air.
Meaning bigger hits to profits as industries are forced to make expensive upgrades. The public now has 60 days to comment on the proposal before it becomes final. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
The big retail chains have started reporting how their stores did in the crucial month of December, and company-by-company results were mixed. But Thomson Reuters crunched them all together for us today and came up with a 3% increase overall over December last year, which is, and please stop me if you've heard this phrase before, better than analysts were expecting. So do you suppose that means the rest of retail and the rest of the economy are getting better too? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
First, keep in mind that last month's sales are being compared to December 2008, which was a terrible time for retailers, says Ken Perkins of Retail Metrics.
We really didn't recoup what we gave back last year. So while they're better, certainly not where we would be relative to 2 years ago.
And this raises a big question. Should we even be using the free spending years before the recession to benchmark today's retail economy and expecting sales to ever reach that level again?
You know, there seems to be this transformational change in the economy where consumers have become more frugal. And certainly, consumers cannot use their homes as piggy banks as they did in the mid-2000s to just continue to take equity out and buy whatever they wanted with it.
Economist Sarah Johnson of IHS Global Insight says retailers just can't count on consumers to spend like they used to.
Consumers are value shoppers. They're saving more of their income. They're attempting to reduce their debt burdens and rebuild their retirement savings. So this will be a cautious environment for retailers for several years to come.
One bright spot is online sales, which have continued to grow by double digits even in the recession. But that hasn't boosted retail sales overall, says Sucharita Mulparu of Forrester Research. It's just shifted sales away from malls and department stores.
The web is definitely taking market share away from store-based retailers. Often it's taking away from some of those weaker retailers that have already gone out of business.
But Mulparu says healthier retailers like Nordstrom and Best Buy are holding their own. That's because they also now have extensive websites that offer consumers deep discounts and opportunities to comparison shop. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was an interesting tidbit about the housing market that hit the news wires today, and as we have become accustomed, it was sort of counterintuitive. According to a real estate research company, apartment vacancies hit 8% in the past quarter. That is the highest apartment vacancy rate in 30 years. And so here's the disconnect. With so many people losing their homes, you'd figure more people would actually be moving into apartments, right? Not out. We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler to figure out what's going on.
Apartment developers expected to see an increase in the number of renters, so they started building a couple of years ago. Victor Kalinog is with the commercial real estate research firm Reis.
Basically, rentals were supposed to benefit from the housing bust since people would not be buying homes anymore. Developers could still get financing in 2006. Rents really grew in 2007, so a lot of projects were begun in 2006 and 2007.
He says 120,000 new apartments came on the market last year, but there was less demand. People are sharing apartments with roommates or moving back in with their parents. Kalinog says that's created a renter's market.
If you're a landlord and you're operating an older building, suddenly across the street a new building comes in, 50% vacant, with much better amenities, willing to offer 3 months off, what are you going to do to attract or retain tenants? You're probably going to have to match that kind of competition.
Renters are finding some deals in Northern Virginia. Sean Farr is with the Apartment and Office Building Association of Metropolitan Washington, D.C. He says landlords are offering incentives.
Waiving a security deposit and then thereafter granting free rent in whatever increment is deemed necessary to get the lease signed.
He says renters in Northern Virginia are negotiating 1, 2, and even 3 months of free rent. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
For what it's worth, a couple of major housing stock indexes did pretty well today. Across the broader markets, though, it was another mixed session. Lackluster one at that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you've been listening to this program or reading the business pages, you have no doubt heard about the various firms that are trying to buy the candy maker Cadbury. Kraft's $17 billion bid was too low for the British company, also too high for Kraft's biggest shareholder, Warren Buffett. He said ixnay to that eel day. So Cadbury board members have reportedly started talking to the folks at Hershey, I imagine trying to gin up a counteroffer there. Now, I like a good candy bar as much as the next guy, but this does seem like a whole lot of fuss about chocolate. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains all that maneuvering. It's not as crazy as it sounds.
We may be cutting back on houses, cars, electronics, and eating out, but chocolate appears to be totally recession-proof. The market research firm Mintel says Americans bought about 2.5% more chocolate in 2009 than they did in 2008.
Chocolate provides a certain comfort, even when times are bad.
Marcia Mogolansky is a global food and drink analyst at Mintel. She says the real growth is overseas. In India, for instance, chocolate sales grew almost 17% as the world plunged into the economic slump.
You know, you wouldn't think of India as a great chocolate country because of the temperature. Chocolate will melt. You can't have it in the corner store. But what's been happening as the Indian economy develops, there's been a growing network of air-conditioned malls opening up across India. And in those air-conditioned malls, you can sell chocolate.
Keeping chocolate cool is not a problem right now here in frigid New York City. I stopped by a chocolate store in Rockefeller Center and found Evelyn McGrath ogling the window display. She says she's making less money now, but still eats chocolate every other day.
I don't know. I just really like chocolate. I like dark chocolate a lot. And they say that it's healthier for you if you can eat like the 60% dark chocolate, like at least once a day. It's better for your heart or something.
Ah, the things we tell ourselves. Kenise Scoops not making any excuses. She admits despite the recession, her chocolate buying habits haven't changed.
No, they probably should have, but they haven't.
Still buying the same amount?
Possibly more, actually.
Scoops in good company. Mintel reports chocolate has become a substitute for other items in this recession. As in, forget the diamonds for Valentine's Day. How about a heart-shaped box of chocolate truffles instead? In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The recession that we are just now beginning to work our way out of has been miserable for a huge chunk of the country. For economists, though, it has literally been a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see how some of the dominant theories in the dismal science hold up in reality. There are, in essence, two of those theories, one based on the idea of John Maynard Keynes, the other popularized by Nobel Prize winner Milton Friedman and named after the university where he taught, the University of Chicago. The Great Recession of 08-09 has exposed some weaknesses in Friedman's ideas, and in the most recent issue of The New Yorker magazine, staff writer John Cassidy explores the decline and fall of the Chicago School of Economics. When we talked, I asked him if he would to start with a little primer.
The basic idea of Chicago School Economics is that the free market, left to its own devices, works well. So it doesn't need much government intervention, and indeed, government interventions, if they are put into effect, will tend to go wrong.
And in the magazine this week, you profile a guy named Richard Posner. He's a federal judge in New York, and he is, as you say, a convert now. He says it doesn't work anymore, basically.
Richard Posner is one of the most famous members of the Chicago School. He was largely responsible for growing the law and economics movement, which has helped populate a lot of American courtrooms with conservative judges and with judges who take free market economics very seriously. Last year, in the wake of the financial crisis, Judge Posner had a conversion and went from being a sort of standard Chicago School economist to being a Keynesian.
When you say Keynes, it's John Maynard Keynes. Explain briefly what it was that he said.
In the free market view of things, economies are naturally self-correcting. If a recession starts, it will quickly bounce back and unemployment won't go up very high, won't stay very high. Keynes said, no, that's not true. Because of a variety of reasons, economies can get stuck in a recession and you can have high unemployment for years on end and things can feed on themselves. So in order to avoid that outcome, he said government needs to step in and spend money.
Well, make the connection for me, though, between the efficient markets theory and regulation and the attitude toward the markets in Washington.
Well, the efficient markets hypothesis, although it's sort of obscure economic theory in one sense, also had very practical impact in that it underpinned a lot of the deregulation in the 1990s and 1980s. The basic idea behind that deregulation was that financial markets, if you left them to their own devices, wouldn't depart from economic fundamentals. Prices in the market would reflect what companies are really worth, or in the housing market, what houses are really worth. There wouldn't be any speculative bubbles, for example. That's what Alan Greenspan said. That's what Bob Rubin and Larry Summers said when they were Treasury Secretaries, and it justified a whole range of deregulatory measures taken to allow banks and investment banks to get together and invest in all sorts of securities, such as credit default swaps and subprime mortgage securities, all these things we've heard a lot about in the last few years. Turns out, however, markets aren't always efficient. Twice in the last 10 years, we've had enormous speculative bubbles.
You spent a lot of time out in Chicago. It's clear in that article. And you talked to a bunch of people. Relate for us what they said when you went out to these Chicago school people and said, hey, what sense do you make of the last 2 years in this market if you believe that the market knows everything?
The reactions really were across the board. Some of the people I spoke to said, look, this is just a one-off. It doesn't invalidate the general idea that markets work well and that financial markets work well. Other people, such as Gary Becker, who is one of the Nobel laureates of Chicago, said, no, it's more serious than that. markets aren't always efficient, and we have to rethink that side of things. If we go back to the two notions of Chicago economics, one that the market always works well and one that the government always works badly, the first one has sort of gone out the window. But they do tend to fall back on the second idea, that that doesn't mean that governments will do any better.
You point out in your piece that that really a lot of the heat of the moment of the financial crisis is what drove people to re-examine their ideas of models of economics. And now a lot of that heat, frankly, has kind of dissipated.
Right. Well, actually, one of the things which Gary Becker said to me was that about a year ago, he thought there'd be a complete revolution in economics. But 12 months later, the economy looks more healthy than it did a year ago. And the sort of urgency of the debate has gone out of it a bit. And he thinks there will be some moderate changes to economics, but there won't be a whole new paradigm.
Safe to say, though, it'll be more nuanced. It won't be all black and white.
You would hope so. One would hope that things will be more nuanced. But you never really know in economics. I mean, there could be some new genius out there somewhere who comes up with a theory which everybody buys into. I tend to think that's unlikely, but you never know.
John Cassidy, he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His new book is called How Markets Fail. Mr. Cassidy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, Latino students struggle to get ahead.
I want to have a professional job, not like my family, like gardeners, fast food restaurants, construction workers. I want to do something different.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 33 points today, almost a third of 1%, closed at 10,606. But the Nasdaq pretty much flatlined again, shaved off 1 point, closed at an even 2,300, 2300 the number. The S&P 500 tacked on 4 points, 0.4%, wrapped up the trading day at 1141. The money really was in financials today. They were lifted by an analyst upgrade of Bank of America, led the way with a bounce of more than 3%. Wells Fargo stock banked a similar rise. Shares of J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs advanced nearly 2%. Shares of Lennar Corporation jumped nearly 13% today after the home builder reported its first quarterly profit in almost 3 years. Bond prices mostly unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 3.83%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Labor Department lets us know how many Americans were unemployed in December. The Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on consumer credit. And on January 8, 1790, George Washington delivered the first State of the Union address in New York City. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Consumer Electronics Show opened its doors to the public in Las Vegas today. The latest in games, gear, and gadgetry will be on display. As we do when we've got gadget-related questions, we've got Kevin Pereira from G4 Television on the line. He is up in Vegas this week. And Kevin, listen, for those of us, including me, by the way, who've never been to one of these things, what is this show all about?
I always describe it every year as sort of the nerd mecca that every pasty white tech-savvy guy needs to make the journey to, and it's no different this year. 2010 is crazy. It's CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, and all the major players in everything that blinks or takes battery power show up to show off their products for the year. and consumers get a chance to come in and take a look at them. So it really is a big digital playground and a chance to see cutting-edge technology before it actually hits the shelves.
Give me a sense of what it's like this year with the economy slightly recovering versus last year and the depths of a really bad recession.
Other than finding a $5 table at the Palazzo or the Venetian, which is unheard of, you don't really notice the recession, and that's been the most surprising thing. Thus far, all the manufacturers are bringing out products that range anywhere from, you know, $40 all the way up to $10,000 3D television sets. So they're ignoring the recession pretty heavily here, and the products are definitely reflecting that.
What's your sense of the hot products? I mean, as you mentioned, 3D televisions, what else?
Kai, honestly, I thought at first I was going to tell you guys to just copy and paste whatever I said last year and make it a little louder. Because that's what CES tends to be lately. It's all iterations. It's, well, devices are getting smaller, there's more storage, and they're faster. But this year we're seeing some really cool stuff. Obviously, yes, 3D television in the home, that's a big push. Honestly, I don't think it's going to be ready for major mass consumer consumption until 2011, maybe 2012 at the earliest. But if you're looking to early adopt 3D TV, come to CES and check out what's available.
What about, the fancy smartphones and video recorders and all that stuff? I mean, anything we have to know about from this year's CES, or is it just lost in the blurble there?
Again, it's more of the same. It's iterations. I think Google's Nexus One phone caught some people by surprise. I mean, it was the worst-kept secret in the industry, so that's an interesting vibe. But the tablet PC, I think 2010, probably transitioning into 2011, will be the year of the tablet. Apple's expecting to announce something. Last night, I got to see a device by Lenovo, which is a true hybrid laptop, which means you pop open the screen on your laptop and you're typing just fine. Let's say you want to go across the room or walk away and take a train ride, you can literally remove the screen from the laptop and it becomes a portable tablet PC with 16 gigs of storage, its own processor. It's literally a laptop and a tablet all in one for about $1,000. And that really caught me by surprise.
If you could pick one item from the CES this year, only one, that you could have for your own and take home, what would it be, Kevin?
Ooh, that is tough. I will say right now, LG has a line of full LED slim TVs that they're releasing this year, and we're talking less than an inch thick, full LED high-definition television set. They're internet-ready right out of the box with Wi-Fi, so you can stream YouTube videos, Netflix, and they actually announced a partnership with Skype so that whole video conferencing vision of the future where you walk in front of your TV, wave your hand, and suddenly you're chatting with grandma, or hopefully someone far sexier if you're me. Then you can do it. It's here, and it's actually working. It's the closest thing to the hovercraft or jetpack or time machine video conferencing. It's actually here.
Yeah, maybe next year with the hovercraft. Kevin Pereira from G4 Television is our man at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this year. Kevin, thanks a bunch.
Kai, any numbers you want me to play for you on the tables?
No, play Black 12. See what happens.
Done and done, sir.
A report out from the Southern Education Foundation today says the South is the first part of the country where more than half of the children in public schools are minorities. That is happening in part because more Latinos and their larger families are moving in. Latinos are the fastest growing part of the U.S. population, and as the United States tries to keep up with other countries in getting students into and graduated from college, Latinos are getting special attention because they are the least likely to get college degrees. From American Radio Works, Emily Hanford reports.
George Cushman spent most of his career in the corporate world. Then came 9/11, and his position was eliminated. Searching around for something new, he ended up taking a job at the Hispanic College Fund. And it opened his eyes to a huge problem about to hit the nation as baby boomers like him retire.
The number of white professionals leaving the workforce is so large, and the largest population to replace them are Latinos, and they're getting degrees at a third the rate.
The numbers really are daunting. The Census Bureau predicts that by the year 2050, nearly one in three U.S. residents will be Hispanic. And right now, only 13% of Latinos get bachelor's degrees. Boosting that rate is the goal of the Hispanic College Fund. At first, the fund focused on helping students pay for college, but that wasn't enough. Too many kids were dropping out of high school, so the fund started a program for students as young as ninth grade.
I am
excited? I didn't hear that at all. Are you excited?
We created the Hispanic Youth Symposium to get students to believe that they can go to college.
Idalia Fernandez is president of the Hispanic College Fund. The fund sponsors five of these symposia each year. This one's at Towson University in Maryland.
What is your dream? Can you see it? If you can't see it, you'll never achieve it.
Students come to campus for 4 days of motivational speeches like this and to learn practical things like how to fill out financial aid forms. They live in the dorms, eat in the dining hall, get a feel for what college is like. It's the first time many of them have ever been on a college campus.
First, I was like, yeah, I might go to college. Now, I'm like positive. I'm like, got to go to college. I'm going to college.
This is Erman Osorio. He's in 10th grade. A teacher told him about this program.
I want to have a professional job, not like my family, like gardeners, fast food restaurants, construction workers. I want to do something different.
Erman's parents are from El Salvador. They didn't get much education. He says they'd like him to go to college, but they don't know anything about how to help him get there. This is where guidance counselors should come in. But Idalia Fernandez says many Latinos go to poor schools where they don't get good counseling. Or worse, they confront counselors who tell them they're not cut out for college. So students give up.
A lot of the times they self-select out. Why should I apply? Why should I take the SATs?
Fernandez says students and parents sometimes need a little convincing that college is worth the time and money. So when she and her colleagues started the Youth Symposium, they created charts showing how much more money people make with a college degree. But that pitch fell kind of flat. George Cushman explains.
We looked at the students and they were looking at each other saying, how do I explain this to my parents? My house isn't good enough. The car isn't good enough. They're working two jobs, each of them. They're killing themselves, and it isn't good enough.
So instead of emphasizing money, Fernandez says they tell students that a college degree is one way they can improve their communities.
You know, if you go to a hospital and you saw that a family member didn't get the health care they needed because someone didn't understand their language, then you're the one that has to become the health care provider who's bilingual and is going to serve the Latino community.
So far, the appeal seems to be working. The Hispanic College Fund received more than 38,000 applications last year for 600 scholarships. Those numbers seem to say two things. Young Latinos who see college as a possibility are lining up for the opportunity, but they need more help paying for it. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, as we have talked about a couple of times, the President's State of the Union address is set for sometime at the end of this month or maybe the beginning of February. That is not sitting too well with fans of the ABC megaseries Lost. The show's last season is set to start on February 2nd with a three-hour blockbuster. Fearing preemption, though, some of the more, shall we say, vocal fans have started actively lobbying the White House not to pick that night. I don't much follow Lost myself, but I will note there is some reason for them to fear. Mr. Obama gave his Afghanistan speech the same night of Charlie Brown Christmas was set to air. Now, missing that, that was really terrible. Anyway, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 33 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq down a single point, basically flat. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.4%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can get the first word in business and economic news tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. And next time on this particular radio broadcast, part two of our series on Latinos and higher education, how they are always having to play catch up.
Students pass high school exit exams, and 3 months later they show up at college and they're told, you're not ready for college level material.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.